From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have a spellbinding show tonight, and I'm stealing that from the book that's in front of me, A Question of Murder. You'll know my next guest, Donna Kaufman, is a co-author along with the famed forensic pathologist Cyril Weck. Donna is here tonight. We're going to talk a little Anna Nicole, and we're going to start out with something that I'm going to deal with on tomorrow's commentary, using something that Wendy Murphy sent me. But anyway, Donna, hi, how are you?
Hey, Dana, thank you for mentioning the book and for allowing me to talk about Polanski as well. I just today finished a story that will be in the next Globe, which will be nationally next Wednesday or Thursday, about Polanski, and I quote Wendy Murphy in it. So, you know, we're both on the same side here.
Well, tomorrow, with Wendy's permission, I'm actually, my daily commentary will be the two letters that she wrote to Whoopi Goldberg. It's unbelievable. In fact, it's only Wendy. I tried to get her on tonight, but she's busy. So she said, well, why don't you just read them? And I said, I certainly will. Anyway, Donna, if someone who's been around the business as long as you have, seeing a story like this, seeing the reaction, especially from some Hollywood folks, has got to be mind-boggling.
Well, it is, and I think there will be a backlash in the next few days when these people realize, our opinion is not the popular one. When this goes to court in Los Angeles, and I believe it will, the elite show business types who use their power and money to get out of jury duty will not be on the jury. The jury will consist of parents and teachers and good people who don't understand why there should be justice for someone wealthy and powerful. That is an illusion of the law. There's not two sets of rules. There shouldn't be anyway.
Well, you know, we've talked about Hollywood injustice here before with, the likes of Robert Blake and O.J. Simpson. But, now that Phil Spector's in jail and O.J.'s in jail and Polanski, I'm sure, will go to jail after this. Is it time for the Hollywood elite to get their heads out of their rear ends and start waking up? They're no better than anyone else?
Well, you know, a lot of has been written in my local newspaper, the L.A. Times, about this is California needs its money, you know, that we shouldn't be spending money on a trial like this, or it's the right wingers. Well, you couldn't be more liberal than me. and I have to say, this is exactly what I want to spend our money on, prosecuting people who harm children. She was a 13-year-old child, and if you read the transcripts of what happened to her,
exactly,
go to thesmokinggun.com, you will see that she lays out everything, and it's in sickening detail what he did to this girl and then got away with it. I only suspect that the people who are defending him don't know the facts.
Yeah, and I wonder about that too. You know, I saw Dennis Miller on O'Reilly the other night, and O'Reilly asked him the question what he thought, and he said, you know, initially he thought, it's an old man, it's an old case. But then he went in and he read the transcript, and I think he said it best. Is he said, if California spends their last dollar on this case, this man needs to go to jail. There's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Well, bless his heart for saying that and for defending a young girl. And let me say that another thing that crops up is people say, he served his time, and this faux documentary, this advertisement for this creep that was made in 2008 and is now being updated, which HBO should hang its head in shame about putting any money behind, makes the point that he spent 42 days in jail. Well, I don't know why 42 days should be considered an appropriate sentence for drugging and raping a child. But the more important thing is, this was psychiatric evaluation. He was not in the general population. He spent 42 days looking at ink blots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the same kind of hard time.
Yeah.
It was just to determine how wretched an individual he was.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and then he came out of jail, had the hearing before the judge, and the judge had every right to say, I'm not going to accept this plea agreement, and that's when he skedaddled.
Yeah, he took off.
For 31 years.
He took off. He was scared to go to jail. He was scared to have what would have happened to him in jail, and we won't get into that, but that's not what...
I don't think so. You know, usually that doesn't happen at all. It's very, very rare that it does. But let me just think out loud and say, you know, had he gone to jail, he probably would have, with his wealth, been able to serve time very nicely. And instead, he spent 31 years in, France, all globe hopping. And the California authorities have been after him. There were many times in many countries that they got there just before he left town. So he knew that he was being traced. And it was his own arrogance to show up at a film festival. It's like these guys who show up to win a big screen TV and it's part of a police sting. That's completely authorized.
Yeah, I love those. I love those, Donna, when they do the stings like that. But, Polanski aside, and if you're just tuning in, Donna Kaufman is here. You'll know her as the co-author of the book, A Question of Murder, along with Cyril Wecht. And Donna's a crime reporter, author, and producer. We want to talk about Anna Nicole tonight, and there's a couple of chapters, one Daniel Smith and one with about Anna Nicole in the book that covers everything in detail. But a lot of things that have been released here recently about Howard Stern and the two doctors you and Dr. Weck wrote about some time ago. This isn't new stuff, but it certainly is interesting.
Yes, our book came out in February, and everything we wrote about it, it's almost like seeing a rerun of or the film version of our book. Today, Howard Stern was in court, and this is going to be happening up until mid-month when the preliminary hearing begins. They go to court and they do what's called housekeeping, trying to decide what witnesses will be allowed, what won't, what evidence gets in. In California and other states, you have two paths to a trial. One is you can have a grand jury indict, or you can have what's called a preliminary trial, which is kind of a mini trial, and that's what we're doing in this case. And that will begin in mid-October, mid of this month, and assuming the judge finds that there's reason to go forward with the trial, that will begin the big trial, the real one, downtown L.A. in November 28th.
Now,
the preliminary will consist of about 90 witnesses, so for a little trial, it's still quite advanced. About two-thirds of those will be prosecution witnesses, and one-third will be defense witnesses. And an important thing that happened recently is the judge refused to sever the three defendants. And that means they will all be tried together. Doctors Kapoor, Sandeep Kapoor, Christina Rashevitz, the internist and psychiatrist, respectively, and Howard K. Stern, who was Anna's attorney and, some would say, he would say, boyfriend. And so instead, all of these three people wanted their trials separated so that they could say, no, I didn't do anything. It was that person.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge said, nothing doing.
You know, reading the book, and I don't want to give it away, I want people to go out and buy it, and by the way, it's an excellent book, and when I use the term spellbinding at the start, it's Ann Rule, you'll know her as a best-selling author, says this will become a classic in the genre. It's spellbinding, and it is. It keeps you interested. You and Dr. Weck both write about Howard and his being vilified in the media, and you know what, even me, little old me here, I agreed with that, and then as time went on and as we started to look at this case more, even I got a lawyer or a letter from Howard's lawyer saying don't say bad things about my client on air, so I guess they even listened to my little old show, that Howard started to look a little bit like, I hate to quote Judge Seidlin because we'll get into him in a little bit, that enabler that he was, and we've got other sick things with the psychiatrist and the bathtub and things like that nobody ever knew, and how weird was this?
Well, you know, one of the main charges against all three defendants is that they acted inappropriate. But wait, let me just get back to what you said. Your show is listened to worldwide. You archive your files, so all sorts of interested listeners can pull up a file whenever they want to.
Right.
You make a huge impact, and you cover all these cases, and my hat's off to you. And I thank you very much for doing this with the right intention, for giving all sides a chance to speak. I think that our book, because remember, Dr. Wett was employed by Howard and Anna to do Daniel's second autopsy and traveled from his home base in Pittsburgh to Nassau to perform that. And then when Anna died, Howard and his attorneys asked Dr. Wett to stay apprised of everything that was happening in Anna News, and they consulted with him. At the same time, I was writing about both cases for Globe and other places, so we were absolutely qualified to talk about this case, and Dr. Wecht only saw one side of Howard and Anna at a point, and then started seeing all the prescription abuse and finding out that perhaps what he was told wasn't the full picture, and I think he really was kind of stunned by this. Not that he isn't well acquainted with celebrity coddling, but I think this took it to a new extent.
Well, once he started to see the results of the, you know, the autopsy results and started to look at the big picture, just the prescriptions alone and some of the narcotics was mind-boggling.
Well, right. And Dr. Wecht had never seen Anna's E-Channel show. And I had met Anna years ago at a television taping, and she was just fine and normal. And that was years before she got involved with Howard K. Stern before she was involved with drugs. She was coherent and funny and affable. And when I watched that E-Channel show, my stomach turned.
Yeah.
Who would put this woman in that position where falling over furniture and slurring her words is an excuse for entertainment? Who was holding her back? Who had her interests in mind? Now, who made that deal was Howard. He was also a co-star on the show. And one could argue that if she was just a, you know, upstanding citizen, E! Channel wouldn't have been interested. I was sickened, horrified when I saw that show. This was not what one should be doing. And Howard had one client, Anna.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that was serving her well by, you know, having her, you know, obviously impaired on television. Well, of course, it got worse. And, you know, of course, we will hear in the trial what their defenses are. One of the things that Dr. Chris Rosovich, who was her psychiatrist and took that job so that she would be the one person involved in prescribing Anna everything rather than Anna's previous habit of doctor shopping, this allowed her to have one doctor in charge of everything, which is a really good idea for somebody who has a drug addiction problem. One of the things that she told Dr. Wecht is, Well, yes, I prescribed all these medicines, and I did a Globe story that said it was more than 2,800 pills in a two-month period. But she said, you know, I would try one painkiller, and if that didn't work, I'd try something else, and then would try one anti-anxiety, and if that didn't work, I wouldn't throw out all the pills. I would still have prescribed all those, you know, because it doesn't mean she took them all, which is a reasonable view. But I'm looking at this handwritten fax that Christine Rashevitz wrote to Dr. Kapoor and sent to a pharmacy in California. It was dated 5 days after Daniel's death, when Anna was in the Bahamas and recovering also from 3 days earlier, a cesarean birth.
Mm-hmm.
She was not in good shape, obviously, and her shrink was with her. And this doctor wrote a letter, and you can read about it in the book, which asks for a number of medicines to be filled in the States and then FedEx to her in Nassau, where she would give them to Anna. They were all under a phony name, which is illegal,
mm-hmm.
but Anna had a long history of using phony names, from Michelle Chase to Wilma Flintstone to Susie Wong, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So she talks about Dilaudid, Ativan, Soma, Dalmane, Prestige, Methadone. I mean, enormous quantities. It's like you could start a pharmacy yourself with this amount of medicine. And this list I have in my hand, there are four different painkillers, there are two different sedatives, and a sleeping pill. And so you have to say, well, what about your argument? Doesn't it undermine your argument about we would try one thing, and if it didn't work, we'd try something else? I think this is the kind of thing that the California Attorney General and the Department of Justice looked at and said, there's something really wrong here.
Yeah, it's a big problem. Donna Kaufman is here, a co-author of A Question of Murder. The cast of characters is unbelievable. This is a psychiatrist who seems to have had some sort of sexual relationship with her client. The other doctor, let's talk about Kapoor here a little bit. He's quite a class act himself, is he not?
Well, you know, here's the thing about Kapoor and Rashevitz in their favor. The person... let me back up and say, when these 197 pages were released, which are the mm-hmm. findings from search warrants taken of the doctor's residences and offices, and when they went to Kapoor, he was hiding Anna's medical file under shirts in his bedroom closet at home. So there was, you know, he didn't want these things to be revealed, and they got their hands on them. And it turns out that he prescribed a lot more medicine than he told Dr. Wecht about and is written in our book. So that's interesting. But one of the salacious details that has surfaced is the people who were analyzing on behalf of the search warrants. In other words, there are cops, we're calling cops, federal agents who went in there and confiscated the material. But they are not experts about analyzing it.
Right.
They gave the analysis to a trained medical doctor who looked at the evidence and said, this is outrageous. These drugs are absurd. And one of the things this doctor said is it seems that there is sexual conduct, between Anna and her two doctors. Kapoor, there were photos taken from Anna's hard drive, one of which is Kapoor at a gay pride parade in Los Angeles, West Hollywood, and Anna is sitting on a car going through town, and Kapoor is next to her with his shirt off, and then there's a picture of them later in the nightclub, and he seems to be nuzzling her neck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Anna loved gay people around her, and Dr. Kapoor is known as an out gay man, so I don't think you could really call that sexual conduct. It's a little too friendly for a doctor-patient, true, mm-hmm. but it's not sexual, overtly sexual. The pictures of Dr. Christina Rashevitz are a little more troubling. there are at least three photos of Christine at in Bahamas at the Nassau house that Anna was renting, and there are photos of Anna and Christine naked in a bathtub, cuddling each other and goofing around, including holding hands and kind of pointing, almost touching Anna's, shall we say, lady parts. And you just wonder, what the heck was that about?
Yep.
Because that does cross a line. This is the same physician, by the way, that Radar Online got photos of her with a straw in her hand about to snort what seemed to be lines of a white powder.
Mm-hmm.
This was after her arrest. And so was this doctor just as party-hardy as Anna was? Is that appropriate in any sense for a doctor? And when I asked Dr. Wecht, who is also a lawyer, he said he had doubts that this material would actually get into a courtroom, and that he did not find it very good doctoring, and that she could lose her medical license over something like this very easily. And I think you have two doctors with medical licenses, and Howard K. Stern, who has a law degree, they could each have lost their ability to function in their known professions by what happened with Anna. But, you know, the more serious charges are what will happen in court. Did they knowingly give this woman, who was an addict, medicine that sent her over the edge? And did they enable her? In Howard's case, he's being charged with enabling her by allowing prescriptions to be written in his name, his relatives' names, and others. And he knowingly gave her the medicine to take on every 4 hours. So there will be testimony, I am certain, by people who observed these, you know, wake up and take your medicine treatments, and there are signed affidavits from people. So this, you know, when this is all shaken out in court, it will be quite eye-opening.
Absolutely, and of course you can read more about it in Donna's book, along with Sarah Wecht, called A Question of Murder.
The book gets also into, as you know, the lives of these people, not just their deaths, but Anna's life was just the thing of an opera, wasn't it? I mean, just really outrageous, over-the-top life. And yet, you know, there was a likability about this woman.
Yep.
That you could see why people were drawn to her.
Absolutely.
And continue to be.
Absolutely. It's you know, to steal from the old show, a true Hollywood story for sure. Judge Seidlin, who has since retired, you see him now as a commentator or an analyst on, I think, Geraldo Rivera's show or something like that. He is a part of your book and a part of that chapter in itself. Let's talk a little bit about Judge Seidlin.
Well, you know, I don't know why they have him on as a legal authority, because he's really pretty much what he was at the time he left Florida, one step ahead of the law, and I think facing some charges himself.
Yep.
Everything in our book is completely sourced, and all the sources are offered there, so you can read up on anything that we tease you with. You can go to the original source material. But Judge Seidlin is definitely a character, and I just couldn't believe some of the things I discovered about this guy.
Oh yeah, just seeing him on Geraldo, it makes you wonder. I guess he didn't get his own judge's show, but he was, and I want to talk a little bit about this just before we let you go, Donna. He was unless he was like that all the time in his courtroom, I don't know, I wasn't there, but one has to wonder if he wasn't mesmerized by the cameras, and we saw it with Judge Ito. Will we see it in a Michael Jackson trial that will probably come up soon? I don't know. Let's talk about the influence of the cameras in the courtroom and the judges that want to be famous.
Well, that is a good thing, I think, because it allows people to see the
yes.
unvarnished evidence. You don't have somebody on Court TV, whatever they're calling it today, interpreting for you and perhaps showing their bias in talking about it. So you get to see the good thing. We have a Supreme Court here that operates in secrecy. I wish that our U.S. Supreme Court had cameras in its courtroom so we could see what their process is in hearing evidence. I wish there were cameras in the judges' chambers. You know, more cameras the better. Do they perform for the cameras? Well, that was Polanski's argument in one of the reasons he didn't want to come back is
yep.
because it might be photographed. You know, he might have camera in the courtroom. Well, you say you're innocent. What do you get to hide, buddy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's a good thing, and I will take the judges who perform for the cameras, if you want to call it that. And you know, one of the things about Seidlin is after I talk about his up and down history, his personal history, his own legal woes, I also make the point that legally he did the right thing
mm-hmm. yep.
when it came to Anna Nicole, and he found the right material to cite as a precedent.
Yep.
So whether that was him or his clerks, I don't know, but that was a good judgment.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was the whole spectacle was just something that either you loved it, you hated it, or you can say for sure that everyone was interested in it. What are you up to now, Donna?
Well, I just handled, I'm doing Polanski. Elizabeth Smart is back in the news,
yep.
and today there was a story about Elizabeth has testified in a determining whether Brian David Mitchell should go to trial for abducting her in 2005. She admitted for the first time in open court today that every single day that he had her in his power, he raped her.
Oh, geez.
She was a 14-year-old girl when she was taken from her family, from her bedroom, asleep by this monster and his wife, who they are not yet trying. But I think this will be a huge case when it does go to trial. And I believe that there are other victims out there because Brian David Mitchell operated for a long time as a kind of an itinerant nutcase, and his whole thing was loving little girls. And I think there are other victims out there, and I hope that they come forward.
Yeah, and this character does not ever see the light of day again.
Exactly.
Yeah, a quick comment, 30 seconds on the death of John Cooey.
Well, John Evander Cooey, I always wanted to interview. I believe he was very important for law enforcement to talk to and learn
yep.
how the mind of someone like this works. And so this is a loss.
Yep.
I mean, of course, he should never get out of jail. But they missed an opportunity. I'm assuming the FBI's profilers have not sat down with him and did a taped interview. That's the kind of thing that should have happened to let us know how we can guard against people like this.
Yep.
And I believe he was very, very remorseful. He didn't understand what he did. Doesn't excuse his behavior. But we have to learn from these kinds of cases.
Yep, I agree with you. Thank you, Donna. The book is A Question of Murder. You can go on the link on the webpage and make sure you buy it. It's an excellent book. You're always welcome here.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye now. Take care. Bye-bye. That's Donna Kaufman, co-author with Cyril Wecht. One thing about John Cooey is, sit down, interview him, learn from him, and then give him the death penalty. That's my opinion. This is a Dana Pretzer show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. You know, I want to talk a little bit about tomorrow's commentary. If you don't know, I do a daily commentary besides the weekly live radio program, and you can listen to both by going to www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, and you can listen to the show live or pick up podcasts or listen to daily commentary. Tomorrow's daily commentary is going to be something a little bit different. I wanted to get Wendy Murphy on the program tonight, but she wasn't able to come on, but she did tell me to go ahead and share with you, the listener, and I'll do it in a complete entirety tomorrow in the commentary, two letters that she wrote to Whoopi Goldberg regarding Whoopi Goldberg's comments regarding the arrest of Roman Polanski. And I think you'll find this interesting. I'll play a little snippet of it here for you. On today's commentary, I want to share with you an open letter to Whoopi Goldberg, written by my friend and frequent guest here on the program, Wendy Murphy. You'll know Wendy as a former DA, author, a law professor, and victim's advocate. Dear Whoopi, yesterday on The View, you said Roman Polanski pleaded guilty to unlawful sex with a minor, but it wasn't rape, so I've been wondering, what the hell is rape? I know you said your point was to articulate the nature of the crime to which he pleaded guilty, which is entitled unlawful sex with a minor. But you said it was somehow different from rape. It isn't. Unlawful sex with a minor is the crime of child rape in California. So again, I ask you, how is rape different from rape? Regular folks understand rape to mean sexual penetration without consent. And of course, consent is irrelevant when the victim is a child. The law says rape means sexual penetration. The dictionary says rape is for sexual intercourse. No matter which definition source you use, Whoopi, Polanski raped his victim. So I'm trying to understand what you meant when you said it wasn't rape. Did you mean to say it wasn't real rape? What wasn't real enough about the crime for you, Whoopi? A 45-year-old man forced his penis into a 13-year-old child's vagina, and then he forced his penis into her anus. Is this rape, but not rape? The victim was not only a child, but she was also intoxicated because Polanski gave her booze and drugs before the crime. The child protested, told him to stop, but he continued. She was incapacitated to a point where she could barely walk, much less defend herself against her 45-year-old attacker. Is that enough for rape, Whoopi? And you'll hear the rest on tomorrow's commentary. Remember, go to scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll be right back with this week's edition of Nothing But the Sax. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and tonight's Nothing But the Sax, I guess it's a weekly Nothing But the Sax segment. Yeah, Robin Sax, you'll know her as a former ADA at a Los Angeles County television commentator, author, victims advocate, and a very busy lady joins me. Hi, Robin.
Hi there, but I have an issue already.
What?
Guess it's a weekly? What are you guessing for?
I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, listen, people ask all the time about Justice Interrupted. That's something else that you do. You must not sleep more than about 25 minutes a night. That's a weekly radio show. You, Susan Murphy Milano, and Stacey Dietrich host. We're going to start hearing new shows on Tuesday, correct?
That is. The rumor mill is true, and sign on to TMZ.com, and you will see that, yes, in fact, we are actually going back into business on Tuesday.
Okay, what's going to be up on Tuesday, or do you know yet?
Can't tell you.
Oh, you can't tell me. It's a secret, yeah.
And can't tell you. It's top secret, very exciting, and we're going to have the kickoff of a new season. We're very, very excited with lots of new cases in the news and with lots of opportunities now that I am a former prosecutor to spout my mouth off about these cases in Los Angeles, and God knows there's plenty of those as we are discussing tonight.
Actually, speaking of cases in Los Angeles, and I'm going to deal with it more tomorrow in my daily commentary, Roman Polanski, there's something to sit down and chew on. What's your thoughts?
Well, it's probably not very surprising that me, the sex crimes prosecutor, is astonished and disgusted by the fact that this is even a point of debate and contention,
yep,
the case of Roman Polanski. You and I have talked about this before with, you know, Michael Jackson and other great, talented people who may be great, talented people who may have done really not so great, terrible things. And when you do the crime, you got to do the time. And I just feel, as I've said before, is that, you know, it's time for Polanski to man up and take responsibility and deal with the plea that he cut.
No, that's the big contention here is in Hollywood land, and we'll talk about Whoopi Goldberg here in a few minutes, there's this whole, well, we don't blame him for leaving. He would have spent 100 years in jail, blah, 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 blah. There was a dopey HBO documentary that came out. I watched it the other day. And glorifying this creep is just enough to make your skin crawl. Let's compare 1978, I believe, to today with the type of charge that Mr. Polanski is facing and has pled guilty to.
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of ways, a ton has changed since 1978, and with the advent of some of these new sex registry laws and Jessica's Law and Megan's Law and all kinds of victims' rights movements, making sure that there are appropriate sentences and so forth for these kind of crimes. But in other ways, there's not much that has changed. In the Polanski case, if he were charged with the vehicles and the avenues in the penal code today, there would be, with just the six counts that he was charged with, each one of those six counts based on the use of a controlled substance, that being the Quaaludes and the champagne and so forth, in that case, he could have been facing six separate 15-to-life charges that could have been consecutively charged. So, that's where we would have started under today's standards. However, even in that vehicle available to us now, the one thing that is not different, which I find really fascinating, is the charge that he pled to is almost identical to the charge, or is identical, actually, in terms of sentencing, to the charge today. Unlawful sex with a minor, also known as statutory rape, still, from 1978 till now, still is a charge that carries 16 months to a maximum of 3 years in state prison. It is not registrable today. It was not registrable then. So the sentence in and of itself on the charge that he actually pled to is exactly the same, which I find to be rather fascinating.
You know, he got away with... the deal that he got, I guess, in 1978 was a sweet deal, I believe, and he ended up with his arrogance taking off to France, knowing that that's a country that wouldn't extradite him back to the States. Let's talk about that. He's been at large all this time. Will that bear any difference when it comes to sentencing?
Well, before we even get into that, the one thing that I want to say is that if you and I were having this segment in 1978, you and I would be sitting here talking about, was there celebrity justice here, and did Polanski get a sweet deal? And you bet your bottom dollar that he got a sweet deal.
Yep.
And that's what's so offensive to me about this case is, when someone doesn't realize a gift and someone doesn't appreciate a gift, I mean, I understand there was judicial misconduct and problems within this case. There was issues within this case. But it doesn't change the fact that he not only admitted to the crimes to the police in the initial investigation, but in subsequent interviews, even as recently as his 60-minute interview where he says, I didn't realize what I did was wrong then, but I realize what I did was wrong now. Well, you know what? So take that sentence and skip up and down and high-five yourself that your lawyer's got you a sweet deal and say, thank you very much, have a nice day, and get your butt in custody as far as I'm concerned. But going to the whole absconding and fleeing issue, in every other aspect of life, anybody who were to take off would get punished additionally. I mean, from our kids, don't we teach from a very young age, if you just admit to what you did, it's not going to be as bad as if you lie about it or you didn't tell me about it. and you get in trouble for the lying and the hiding more than you get in trouble for the crime itself in many cases. And we know that that cover-up makes things worse. So, yes, he could be and should be held accountable for that lying and absconding, although if I were to look in my L.A. County D.A. glass ball, my guess would be that if he just get the original sentence that they were looking at get that to go away, they may just do away with that absconding and fleeing problem.
And Robin Sachs is here. This is our Nothing But the Sachs segment. When you look at this and you look at this case, and there are few of us initially that came out swinging when Whoopi Goldberg made her comments and the Hollywood elite started to stand behind Polanski. Robin, is it just because there's an arrogance in Hollywood with these people? Dennis Miller said it well, I think, on O'Reilly the other night, that when he first heard about the case, he thought, well, this is an old man and a 30-some-year-old case. And then he said, I read the transcripts, and now I hope California spends every dime that they have in their bankrupt coffers to bring this jerk back and send him to jail. Well, what is this? What is it all about? How come we're not being able to educate the Whoopi Goldbergs of the world, or is she just too arrogant?
Well, I think it's the belief system that it's the Hollywood defense, the unwritten Hollywood defense. As a matter of fact, we've seen it recently. This Randy Quaid story from last week where he decided that he thought that he could stiff the San Ysidro Ranch and had done that before in Bel Air, and he used the, I was trying out for my part or I wanted publicity. You know, Winona Ryder has done that. Tatum O'Neill did that in her crack cocaine case. And for every other person who has done that and used that excuse, it's blown up in their face. But for some reason, you throw the Hollywood, and you then throw old Hollywood into it.
Yeah.
Because here it's a little bit different. Is, you know, some people would say that Randy Quaid and Winona Ryder and Tatum O'Neill were not, you know, the level of which that Roman Polanski is. And so you throw that avenue in it, and there is this, you know, get-out-of-jail-free card that does seem to exist. And the thing that's so astonishing and so disgusting is that it's the celebrity who has the power to actually bring awareness to this very important issue. I mean, we just got out of the throes of Mackenzie Phillips' disclosure last week. We were all talking about, you know, her being molested and involved in an incestual relationship with her dad, and everyone sitting here saying, well, it's consensual, and then give me a break. There is no such thing. Sense and the language that these people use, and they think that they're quoting from the law, and the Deborah Winger calling this an arcane law, is just atrocious.
Yeah. No, oh, absolutely. And it will be something for sure that we'll all sit back.
I have to say one thing, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Dana. One of the problems with it is it's very interesting, because when I was about to go on TV last week on this, and I've been on several shows this week, you know, from Fox to CNN, so, you know, nonpartisan, all the shows, all the parties, all the people, I'll say it like it is. And one of the things that people would tell me before I got on said, okay, now be careful what you're saying, because, you know, you're on television and Hollywood's watching. I'm like, give me a frickin' break. I think that that's what the concern are, is that you got to start looking at who owns these networks.
Yep.
Who are the people that give people these airwaves? Why are they allowing this stuff to happen? And why aren't we seeing more Lisa Kudrows who are using their celebrity to make change?
That's why you're such a good host, because I was just about to say in my stumbling way is that it's people like you and the Wendy Murphys and the others that come forward, tell it like it is, and that's what we need more of in Hollywood. Robin's website is robinsachs.com. You'll see her on all the cable news shows. She's an author, and Justice Interrupted returns Tuesday night on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Dana.
Talk to you soon. That's Robin Sachs with this week's Nothing But the Sachs segment. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. At our last segment tonight, we have Anna Moss. Anna is a domestic violence expert and author, and I want you to check out her webpage. There's a link in the show notes. Or if you can't find those, go to www.relationshipredflags.com. That's relationshipredflags. That's all one word, .com. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dana. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. Now, before we get started, I've actually been asking all my guests, because I think that you all need to have a word in this, and more of us need to have an opportunity to say something. It doesn't have to do directly with domestic violence, but certainly has to do with violence and the perception in Hollywood. I'd like you to comment a little bit about the Roman Polanski case and how some in the media are saying they should just leave him alone, which I believe is absolute nonsense.
Well, I agree. It is nonsense. Pedophilia is serious for a lot of reasons, and someone who develops into an adult pedophile is very disturbed, regardless of what they've accomplished in their outer life. And the nature of pedophilia and spousal abuse is that it gets worse with time.
Yep.
These people are seeking gratification. They're in denial about who and what they are. And there's really nothing personal about it, even though a lot of the acts that they commit are very personal in nature.
And, you know,
they're simply seeking control and gratification. and it takes more and more as they get older to gratify them.
And you know, Anna, I said that initially it didn't tie in together, but it actually it does. A lot of violence, domestic abusers do have a thing with porn, kiddie porn, pedophilia, you name it. Because, like you say, it's I believe it all ties in together. Violence, the whole aspect of the cycle of violence, and things like pedophilia and pornography, etc. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I don't know a whole lot about that because I focus so much on spousal abuse, but I have read extensively the work of a MD and PhD named Bruce Perry, who's one of the international authorities on the development of the brain and the effects of trauma in childhood on later life. And it's hard to come to any other conclusion about the seriousness of pedophilia and spousal abuse going out in all these directions.
Tonight, I thought I'd bring you on to talk about, and of course I encourage everyone to go to your website. When we look at...
I didn't hear that.
I brought you on tonight, Anna. Are you able to hear me okay?
Barely.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not sure what's happening. I think we're having problems with the phone line. But I brought you on tonight so we could talk about the warning signs of an abusive individual, what to look for. Most people just turn their heads because if it doesn't affect them, they're really not interested or they don't want to get involved. But there are warning signs that we should all look for.
Yeah, there certainly are. And one of the chilling things is that whether you're encountering interpersonal abuse at home, at the office, in politics, these people use a lot of the same tricks. So let me mention a couple of them.
Sure.
One is that they tend to be very charming and outgoing, and they do this because they have to enroll and engage their target, and they tend to have very good social skills. Their speech and their language and the emotional energy of their exchanges have what I call perfect pitch. The language that they use is often very directive in terms of where they want the relationship to go. This can add a lot of drama to exchanges. And it can become suggestive in terms of desired intimacy and so forth. These people pay very close attention to what their target is doing, and this can be extra helpfulness, unusual level of interest. It can turn into hovering, smothering, micromanaging, and that in later stages can lead to sabotaging and profound interference. They often like to rush you. Time tricks will help them get to know you, get your contact information, find ways to communicate with you. Then they can try to rush you into making decisions about the nature of the relationship, and this tends to increase the margin of error for the target. It tends to interfere with emotional processing, you know, having enough time to think and feel and sort things out as they're happening. And it also tends to just kind of separate you from your gut feelings.
Right.
Isolation is another trick, whether it means closing an office door or whether it means getting the target to relocate, getting the target to leave some of her friendships or activities behind. Anything that gets the target away from other people who could hear and interfere in what's going on. And I say, I'm using male and female pronouns minimally, but from what's reported, we do know that about 90% of the perpetrators are male. So I'm not being sexist here. I'm just working with what we know. And, of course, what we know so far is simply what's been reported.
You know, those are the statistics. And what might that master abuser say to his target, Anna?
Those things change. The things that the abuser says and does change, of course, as the abuse progresses over time in whatever the relationship is. In terms of rushing, he might tell the target to be ready at one time and then, without any notice, change that so that she is at a great disadvantage and dealing with considerable inconvenience, which he will then or later punish her for. He can plan the day, or he can arrange activities so that she is just continually burdened and rushed and unable to attend to her own responsibilities. With isolating, he could say things like, well, I never saw that letter. I never heard the phone ring. You don't need to go back there. You don't need to go alone. We'll do that together.
Right.
Or, you spend too much time, da-da-da.
And it's a controlling aspect you know, smothering, I think you used that term earlier, but it's that control. And, yeah, don't feel bad about using the male aspect. The statistics don't lie, and it's I consider it an epidemic. And I guess I'm going to give you the last word, Anna. What more can the media do and programs like mine and others to educate the people? Because I believe that education is a big part of this.
Absolutely. Awareness and education is going to allow us to prevent these kinds of activities. We can't prevent the development of abusers yet, but once you know the hallmarks of the character and the behavior, you can start to see it. You know, before I learned this, I knew it very little about it. Now that I know this, I see it everywhere.
Learning, you're able to react. That's the same in anything in life. And, you know, I remind you to go to Anna's website at www.relationshipredflags.com. That's relationshipredflags.com. We have a link on the show notes. Purchase her book, and let's do what we can to help prevent and handle the epidemic of domestic violence. Thanks for coming on, Anna.
Thanks, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Anna Moss, and we try to do what we can here on Scared Monkeys Radio to help with the epidemic of domestic violence and bring on guests to educate you. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure and tune in to ScaredMonkeysRadio.com to listen to the show live, and in particular, check out tomorrow's commentary, a letter from Wendy Murphy to Whoopi Goldberg. I think you will enjoy it. Thanks for listening. Good night, everyone.
Listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.